Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jeannie Lee from the University of Arizona. Joining us today in this episode is Dr. Satsuki Takahashi and her new book, Fukushima Futures, Survival Stories in a Repeatedly Ruined Seascape. This book was published last month through University of Washington Press. Satsuki is an environmental anthropologist of Japan, and this book comes from Satsuki's ethnographical studies about the fishing industry around the Fukushima areas before and after the March 11th earthquake and nuclear power plant meltdown. Welcome, Satsuki. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So first, can you tell us a bit about yourself? What do you research and teach about?
Thank you very much. And I'm a professor of cultural anthropology at Hosei University, which is located in Tokyo. And for my teaching, in addition to freshman seminars and the intro course for sustainability studies, I teach mainly environmental anthropology and anthropology of disasters. And I also teach seminar courses on ethnographic research methods. And for my research, I have been fascinated by ocean-human relations in contemporary Japan. And I've done ethnographic research on topics like culture of fishing, commercial fishing, and also marine conservation, coastal development, disasters, futurism, modernization, and also multi-species relationships. That's a quick introduction, but that's like that.
That's a very wide research interest range. What first got you interested in this study of fishing industry and ocean seascape?
Oh, thank you very much for asking that. Whenever I explain myself to people who are interested in my research, I often say that I've been for a long time, I've been fish geek. But I was born in a coastless prefecture named the Saitama Prefecture. So for me, somebody who was interested in the environment, the ocean was a part of the, you know, the large scale of the environmental milieu, but at the same time, it was foreign to me. The ocean wasn't something that was close to me, or my family and I often go to a mountainside for the summer vacation. So the ocean is always kind of like outside of my hometown. So I was interested in studying ocean and ocean creatures as a high school student. So I went to a fisheries universities in Tokyo. So I've been interested in the ocean since I was in college. And then when I chose to go to a PhD program, I was interested in discovering more of the human side of the fishing. So I studied with environmental anthropologists in Rutgers University. And ever since then, I'm still fascinated by the ocean-human relationship.
That's living in Tucson, Arizona, in the middle of the desert, I kind of relate to that fascination about the ocean. Well, this book, however, is not all about the fun that we can have around the ocean. And for listeners who may not be familiar with this incident, what happened in Fukushima?
Thanks for asking the question. Actually, I found it very interesting to answer that question, especially because more and more college students, even within Japan, because I teach Japanese, the students who go to a school in Japan, and I I have to often explain what happened in Fukushima to those students in Japan as well, and mainly because it happened almost 13 years ago in 2011. So for example, like for the freshman year students right now, back then there were five. So for them, it's really happened a long time ago. For me, it's not that long time ago. It happened in the middle of my research. But so I have to explain to students. So I'm happy to explain the quick overview of what happened back in 2011. So it's a very quick overview, if I may. It happened, the disaster itself happened in 2011 as a triple disaster, which means in a combination of an earthquake, tsunami, and a nuclear accident. And the earthquake and the tsunami struck the long stretch of a coastal area in northeastern Japan, and the tsunami especially hit hard in Tohoku area, which includes Fukushima. And Fukushima is one of the Tohoku area. And along the disaster-struck coast areas, there are a few nuclear power plants. Japan has a lot of nuclear power plants, and all of them are located along a coastal line, including the Tohoku areas. And in Fukushima, there are at least the two major ones. And one of them in Fukushima is called the Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Power Plant. It went to, it caused the tsunami caused the nuclear meltdown, and due to the loss of power and emergency a loss of emergency safety measures. So as a result, a large amount of nuclear substances were released into the air as well as the ocean, which forced over 150,000 people to evacuate from their own hometowns, and it caused the farmers and the fishing families unable to grow their produces or catch fish for multiple years due to the nuclear contamination, and the consumers' hesitation for purchasing the products from Fukushima and the neighboring regions. And that's kind of a quick overview that I often give to my students, but I understand that the listeners might be from more diverse backgrounds. So if you think I should add anything more, please let me know. But that's kind of a quick overview of what happened in Fukushima back in 2011.
Thank you. And conveniently, Netflix just released a mini series this year talking about what happened immediately after the nuclear plant meltdown. So if anyone's interested, you can check that out. But your book focuses on this lesser, I guess, known aspects of the aftermath of the nuclear power plant meltdown. And your primarily examine the oceans and fisheries around this area. Can you give us an overview of this this Joban seascape that you research about and its fishing industries before the disasters? And can you talk about how the disasters shaped or transformed your research since it happened in the middle of your research?
Right. Let me answer the question. There are a few questions. So let me start with, should I start with what was the fishing industry like before the disaster and the overall history of the fishing community and an industry in the Fukushima and the neighboring areas? So the coastal fishing industry in Japan has a long history, and the Joban Sea, which it combines the coastal area of Fukushima and Ibaraki, which is directly south of the Fukushima prefecture, and the Ibaraki prefecture is north of Chiba prefecture, which is a part of the Kanto area next to Tokyo. So the Ibaraki is not that far from Tokyo, and the Fukushima is right above Ibaraki, if you can picture the northeastern Japan map, and that's it's located. And the Joban Sea has been long known as the good fishing ground, and because it's a close proximity to Tokyo, the coastal fish products, the fresh fish coming from Fukushima and Ibaraki, have been highly regarded as high quality fish. It's the big and then also the fresh, because, you know, the these days the transportation system is so good, so that the, even the fish from like Hokkaido or the Okinawa can reach to a Tokyo main fish market without any, you know, too much a delay. But for a long time, the fishing communities in Ibaraki and Fukushima, which is overall called the Joban area, the Joban Sea, the fish products have been considered as one of the premier fish products at the main fish market in Tokyo. And as far as the fishing industry goes, this is more like the Japanese coastal fishing industry 101, but let me start with that just to give you a little more detail the history of it. But like as a big picture of the coastal fishing industry as a history in Japan, the coastal fishing industry has a long history. It used to be just considered at a small scale, more like artisanal fishing before the World War II. It was small scale, and then they used rowboats and wooden boats, unless some of the fishing community has a very wealthy fish manager. But otherwise, it's mostly a family-based small-scale fishing. But it got expanded in the post-World War II period as part of the Japan's national government's effort to modernize the industry. And one of the reasons is the because of the food shortage at the end of the World War II, or after the World War II, they needed the animal protein. So the coastal fishing industry was one of the target for the Japanese government to expand, so that the Japanese citizen can access to the animal protein. So the coastal fishing became a target for the modernization, for the reason of the modernization around that time was more of a mechanization. The idea of a modernization focused on the mechanization of the fishing boats and equipment, so that they can catch more fish to sell, meaning that more fish will be available for general customers. So the fishing industry, coastal fishing industry, became more expanded due to the modernization efforts by the government during the 1950s and 60s. And as a side note, when people often hear the fishing industry, they might think about the large scale fishing industry, and the Japan has a both large scale fishing industry and a small scale coastal fishing industry. The large scale offshore or the deep sea fishing industry have been modernized ever since like Meiji. So that's a little different, a lot different from a coastal fishing. So when you listen to me explaining the history of a coastal fishing, just to be keeping in mind that the coastal fishing industry has a different historical shifts from the deep sea fishing. So for the coastal fishing, it also, the modernization shifted, the discourses of modernization shifted after 1970s. So the 1950s and 1960s, the modernization focused on the mechanization of fishing boats and equipment. And when the time period enters the 1970s and 80s and 90s, when the worldwide environmental movement becoming more of the scene, and Japan Japan was also trying to become one of the first nations, one of the member of the first nation during then, you know, the economic development of Japan trying to catch up with the Western countries. So 1970s through 1990s, the Japanese government shifted the idea of a modernization from just a mechanization, which focused on, increasing the yield, to development of a scientific marine conservation to show we're not just catching the fish. You know, we understand scientifically how the marine ecosystem works, and we do not catch as many as possible, because that's not modern fishing would do. So during that period, modernization shifted from mechanization to marine conservation, development of scientific marine conservation. And then the kind of idea of a modernization shifted again in the beginning of the 2000s to focus on development of a neoliberal market-oriented efficient businesses, which I talk about in that book as well. But besides the historical modernization efforts, the coastal fishing industry in the early 2000s was going through some challenges as well, including declining resources, even though, there are a lot of efforts to establish marine conservation, but there are still concerns about declining the resources. There are complicated reasons. There are some overcatchings involved, but also the temperature rise or the global warming influences as well. So the decline in resources has been one of the main challenges that they face. And then also fish prices has not been increased, even though the increase of fishing costs and especially of fuel costs has been increasing so much. So the benefit or the revenue for the fishing families has been challenging. If the fish price goes up, then they can, you know, the make up for the all the increase in the fishing cost, but it's not the case. So when I did the dissertation research, the field work back in 2006 and 2007, a lot of anxieties that the fishing families shared with me were the declining income because of the stagnant fish prices, while the fuel cost has been increasing. So there are some challenges as well. The people talked about before the disaster struck in 2011. So when the disaster struck in 2011, it was considered as an unprecedented disaster, but also for the fishing communities, it was a huge challenge for them to recover from. They're struggling to survive before the disaster, but after the disaster, because of the contamination of the fish, a lot of the fishing community in Fukushima could not go back to the sea for commercial fishing. And even for the fishing community in Ibaraki, they also had to go through a fishing moratorium for the one of the biggest issues that they are facing right now is the releasing of the treated nuclear waste water. So I'm glad you say that the book is enjoyable to read, but the subject itself it's not easy one to digest, especially for those people who I study with. So I was interested in how the fishing families talk about how to survive in such the seascape that has been very difficult for them to survive with, but they never talk about the giving up or, you know, leaving the fishing industry. So I was interested in how they think about themselves as a fishing families, and then also how the disaster affected them, their identity as a fishing communities, and how they keep their maintain their hope to survive, because especially for those fishing communities in Fukushima, the fishing moratorium lasted for 10 years. They just recently reopened the fishing, but also the issue of the releasing of the treated wastewater or the still concerning with the consumers' worry, you know, the strain, they're worried over the any health issues that might involve with the products from Fukushima. So there are a lot of ongoing challenges that they go through. So I was interested in how they talk about the survival and then also what they actually do with the survival. So as a last question you raised, how the disaster transformed or shaped my research. It did a lot, but I actually finished my dissertation research before the disaster. So I was in an interesting position. I had the dissertation research before the disaster. So it was nothing to do with the disaster, that 2011 disaster, even though I witnessed some other disaster before the disaster, like a tanker accident. So I was already studying the topic of a survival before the 2011 triple disaster. And then I conducted a post-2011 disaster research. So as I was working with the fishing community in the aftermath of 2011, I was kept thinking about like what the 2011 disaster actually means to those people and people who try to survive as a fishing families, and what actually changed. The people talk about the 2011 disaster as unprecedented, but to me, as soon as I began my post-disaster study in 2011, when I joined the meeting of the government's reconstruction discussion, I felt immediately the modernization, the conversation of a modernization pops up in the reconstruction meeting. So to me, even though people talk about the magnitude of a triple disaster as unprecedented, but how the government and then also the people in the coastal area, their treatment of the disaster and the reconstruction is not all that different from the pre-disaster period. So I was very intrigued by the continuation from before the disaster to after the disaster. But there are a lot of changes as well. Like, you know, they never dealt with actual contamination of nuclear substances in the ocean or in the fish body themselves. But the overall discussion of a modernization, the endless pursuit of a modernization as a way to reconstruct the disaster affected area, it felt it's not that foreign to me, remembering what happened before the disaster. So I would say the disaster itself did not transform my research, but kind of expanded my research, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And you mentioned a lot of good points, but since we're talking about modernization and I'm also very interested in this topic, I want to go into more detail about this one. So throughout the book, you use the contrast of modernization and futurism to portray how the fishing families were stuck in between. For the Japanese government, when they made all these great plans, they thought they were modernizing the fishing industry, the boats or the techniques. But what did this modernization mean for the, let me reword that, in the eyes of the fishing families, of those people who actually had to go out there in the ocean to fish? How did they take this modernization? How did they understand it? And how did they like it?
That's a great question. I was wondering about that too when I was living with those fishing families. I did not literally live with them. I had my own apartment, but I visited the fishing port almost every day, unless the weather cancels the fishing trip. I still was going out with, hanging out with the fishing families, even when the fishing trip wasn't scheduled. But I was interested in the modernization. When I used the term in my book, I use specifically how the Japanese government talk about it as kindaika. So the kindaika is the Japanese term for modernization. And that term comes up a lot in the government documents. Like, in order to modernize the fishing, let me rephrase that. In order to help the fishing community, which they frame as backward people, to join the modern Japan, my interpretation is that the Japanese government sees the Tokyo and the central cities as already modernized the areas of Japan, and the people who live in those areas are modernized. But those people who are living in coastal areas or farming sections, there might need to be help to be modernized to join the main part of the Japanese citizen, which are already modernized. So that they use a lot of words to describe that the government needs to help the backward fishing communities to catch up with the city people in Japan. And the modernization, the kindaika, the term comes up in the documents. And then also the kindaika comes up in the conversation among the bureaucrats when they have a meetings, or when they talk about the fisheries issues with me. But the kindaika doesn't, the modernization as a term doesn't come up in the regular conversation among the fishing families, but it kind of interestingly shows up as their own interpretation of the modernization, because the fishing communities often talk to our Japanese government or the fisheries extension station agents in Japan and the many other countries. They have a system, the government creates extension station, the farming or the fishing, and they have a scientist or a scientific-oriented bureaucrat who help the fishing communities or farming community to modernize. Those agents teach them the cutting-edge technologies or the ideas. They're trying to, interpret. The one of my informants who was at that time the fisheries agent, who told me his work as interpreter or the puppeteer, he explained that because the fishing communities of people might not be able to understand the difficult government document words, so including the kindaika. So one of his main job is to digest the term into an easier everyday language so that the people of a fishing community can understand why they need to be modernized and how they need to be modernized and how they need to change their minds to become a more modern fishing communities. So I was interested in how the fishing from fishing communities as how do they listen to it? They have their own pride. They have their, history of being a fishing families. And it was interesting to me to hear how they kind of understand, or they're trying to even use some degree in some situations, the fishing communities understand if they listen to the government, they can get the subsidies. So they kind of strategically use we need to modernize, we need the money. So like, give us some money so that I can get more upgraded fishing gears or in some occasion, conservation. I was mostly interested in the conservation before the disaster, especially because in theory, the marine conservation would be economically beneficial for fishing communities, but not always, because if they can fish and if the resources, the fish species are not in danger of extinction, why not just catch as much as possible, especially it's a seasonal migration involved. So it's hard for them to just not to catch or to catch a little and trying to catch, every month for this amount. It's hard for them to do so because the anchovy might only migrate into their own fishing areas for like a few weeks. And if they don't catch it, they miss a chance of getting a good income. So it's hard for them. To me, it sounded harder for me to believe the conservation efforts is always make sense for them. So I was interested in how some of the fishing communities are more keen to be joining into the, team of the developing the scientific conservation schemes, and some others refuse to do so. And from the government's point of view, for those fishing communities who do not follow the government's modernization efforts, they're considered as a backward. And for those fishing communities who listen to the government, they're considered as a good example of modernization. But from the fishing community's point of view, they have their own reason why they want to follow the government's modernization scheme or not to follow the modernization scheme. And the one of the things that I found very interesting was when the fishing communities follow the government's suggestion on the modernization scheme. For example, when I was conducting my research back in early 2000s, the modernization idea was to develop a neoliberal fish businesses. And I was living in two neighboring fishing communities. The one community was in declined the offer, or they did not want to follow the suggestion. The other one wanted to follow the suggestion. The ones that wanted to follow the suggestion of developing the fish business, they're the ones who were more vulnerable at that point for the survival. So for them, the modernization wasn't really the reason for them to follow the modernization scheme. It was for them to survive. It was a survival strategy to follow the government's suggestion on the developing the vending business. Does that make sense? I mean, I was talking a little bit too much, so I wasn't sure if I answered your question correctly.
Yeah, totally. But it's absolutely fascinating. It almost reminds me of the narrative that, the same story kind of happened in the Meiji period when the same idea of modernization was brought up, but a lot of people didn't understand or they didn't really care what modernization means, actually. So that's a quite interesting parallel that I saw in the part about modernization. Absolutely. and the trouble that they actually caused for the fishing industry. But I was actually very intrigued about this chapter discussing the women's vending business. Can you give us a brief overview of this part?
Sure, I'll be happy to. So, well, the one of my chapter which focused on the before the disaster is the chapter on the women of the fishing communities who are trying to develop the fish vending business, the small fish vending business as a part of their effort to add the additional income to their family revenue. So at that time, as I mentioned earlier, the idea of a modernization, the Japanese government trying to introduce into the fishing community, how the modern fishing families should be imagined, is the So this has happened after mechanization as the development of a conservation. The early 2000 was okay. You do the modernize. You have the modernized the skill set and the fish boats and everything, and you understand the conservation. But now you have to understand that you cannot anymore just trying to survive by catching the fish, because you need to come up with a better plan to earn the business, earn the money. Especially around that time, as I mentioned also the earlier, that one of the challenge was the stagnant fish price, while the cost of the fuel is increasing. So the income for the fishing families is shrinking, and the income of fishing families is one of the biggest concern for the coastal fishing industries. And then also that linked to the another challenge of a decline in the population of fishing communities. And the Japanese government had been helping, you know, the increasing subsidies for them to survive. It's interesting that the fishing community or the fishing industry is one of those industries has been for a long time been described as a declining industry, but it never disappears. And this is one of my colleagues mentioned to me, and which it makes sense, you know, that it's always declining, but never disappear. And it never disappears because of the Japanese government always trying to help the survival of the industry. But because of the neoliberal turn, the Japanese government also entered in the early 2000s. So it's not like a cutoff of the Japanese government from subsidies to the communities, but they use neoliberal narratives to encourage, I don't know if encourage is the right word, but from the government perspectives, they probably use the term, they want to encourage fishing communities to be able to survive by coming up with a strategy to create additional income for themselves. And one of the strategy to do so is to sell their own fish by themselves. Because in the fishing industry, they often catch a fish and then they sell their fish to a middleman or the wholesaler, and the wholesaler sell the fish to the main fish market or something. So for a long time, the fishing communities, their main job was catching the fish, because the selling the fish is another, you know, the world of a business. And then also it's a very difficult ones to do so. But from the government suggestion, based on the government suggestion, you know, they're not suggesting they should sell all their fish by themselves, but they need to come up, or at least they need to have the mindset that they have to survive commercially with neoliberal mindset, or they use a jikosekinin or the self responsibility as very neoliberal term to describe that the Japanese government often uses in order to survive, you need to be responsible for your own survival by coming up with a fish vending business. So that at that time, the fish vending business, they didn't introduce that a lot to men, because the men were the most of the, but there are women fishers as well, but mainly the men are the ones who catch fish by going to the fishing trip. And the women have been responsible for selling the fish, you know, sorting the fish after the fishing boat was returned. And they do all the rest of the work. And so for the government, they targeted those women to be able to practice the neoliberal reform of the fishing and the modernization. So they focused on the Women's Association of the Fishing Co-ops. And the particular fishing communities that I was working with, they were struggling with surviving in the aftermath of the disaster of a tanker accident. They're really struggling to survive and coming up with a strategy to survive, especially some of the available fish species weren't available after the disaster ended, the tanker accident receded. So they were in the position, nothing but listening to the government's suggestion was one of the survival method for them to come up. So there are 12 women, mostly elder women or the middle-aged women, not the young ones, who decided to tag up with the fisheries agents to develop a small fishing business. And they did successfully at the end. But I used that story to kind of allow us to see how the modernization be interpreted by the local fishing families, and especially among women. It's not their the modernization is not their main goal, obviously, but it was survival skills for them to grab as survival survival options to grab on to. So that was the chapter about. So I'm glad to hear that you find it interesting.
I did. I mean, I find a lot of the aspects you mentioned very intriguing. And I guess for the last question, I want to focus on what the government did or what the government tried to do after the disaster, when the central government and local governments also developed plans to revitalize the area. So how did the fisheries respond to the new projects like wind farms, as you mentioned in your book? How successful were these projects actually?
Great question. Thank you very much. So the later chapters that I focused on in my book is mainly in Fukushima. And around this new project was introduced in 2012, and was put into a practice in 2013, which was a floating wind farm project, which is funded by the central government and welcomed by the local government of Fukushima. But at first, for those of people who are not familiar with the wind energy industry, the coastal wind energy, the ocean wind energy is usually posted onto the bottom of the ocean close to the shoreline. But this project is floating. So floating is like offshore. It was the project which was put it into practice in 23 kilometers from the coastal line of the Fukushima, which was located right outside of a 20 kilometer radius from the damaged nuclear power plant, because they could not place any infrastructure within the evacuation zone, which could be extended to the coastal areas or the off to the shore. So it was placed right after the 20 kilometer evacuation zones, so that they can have not easy access, but safe in terms of the nuclear substances. Well, which is not, there's some questions too, but in terms of placement, it was okay to do so. So the floating wind farm was cutting edge. So the Japanese government wanted to use this opportunity of the reconstruction from the 2011 disaster to be another modernization opportunity. So right now, as well as has back in 2011, the Japanese government has been worried about the losing the world competition against China, which is raising in terms of the wind energy and the environmental technology. So that for Japanese government, we might not be able to win against China for inland wind energy or the solar panel, but we might be able to win by, I shouldn't be laughing, but it's kind of very interesting to how the Japanese government idea of a modernization is formulated within this international discussion. But this floating wind farm was the cutting edge Japan team. It was formulated by the consortium, was all formulated by the Japanese National University as well as the Japan-based corporations in order to just to say this is the cutting-edge floating wind energy technology that Japan can produce, and they are doing the one of the other point was they are doing the experimental project in Fukushima, you know, so that they can sell it as a renewable energy project that may be able to replace after the disaster of a nuclear power plant. So the Japanese government was putting into a lot of effort into developing the floating wind energy. And from the local government, it was very welcome. So the Fukushima government, might be an opportunity for them to revitalize their disaster affected area, a new, you know, the energy industry that they can develop. From fishing community's perspective, it was mixed bag because the floating wind energy, even though it's not posted onto the ground of the ocean, the bottom of the ocean, it's still floating. And because they cannot just floating around from one place to another, they have to be in a place even though it's floating. So they have a chain that connecting from the bottom of the floating, the infrastructure to the bottom of the ocean. So the fishing fleets are not going to be able to fish within the certain proximity from the energy station. So for some fishing fleet, including like dredgers, the bottom trawler who needs to troll on the bottom of the ocean, even though it's floating, the floating wind energy is still an obstacle for them to fish for their fishing. So those fishers were opposed to the idea, but some other fishers thought, including the ones that I introduced in my book, some other fishers saw it as opportunity to coexist, because but at that time they weren't able to fish. They were in the middle of a long, at that time they couldn't even see the end of the fishing moratorium. So if the fishing moratorium is, you know, lasts for a decade or two decades, they have to find out how to survive as a fishing families. They don't want to quit. They didn't want to quit. So those fishermen who saw the floating wind of energy might be an opportunity for them to survive as a fishing family. So they mentioned, okay, the wind energy might be an obstacle, but they might be able to help some fishing fleets by developing eco tours, in addition to a small scale fishing. So they saw some hope in the development of the wind energy project, but the wind energy project itself was canceled after almost 10 years. And right now they built the three different kinds of the floating wind farm. But they were all removed from areas because of the cutoff of the budget from the government. The Japanese government are still interested in developing floating wind energies, but they're doing elsewhere other than the Fukushima. there are a lot more politics involved than it might be. We might not have enough time to explain, but Japanese government removed the project entirely after almost 10 years. The people of Fukushima, as well as especially the fishing communities, kind of like a left out from the cancellation of the project of the wind energy.
Thank you. It's just really, I think it's really important to realize how much challenges that the fisheries were put into when a lot of, actually, you can see how this wind energy campaign was working for Japan. Well, a lot of people were looking at Japan, looking up to Japan as an example for this kind of conservation of fish or use of wind energy. But as your book portrays, the fisher families are kind of the ones that are stuck in between this nice vision of the government and the hard situation of the ocean after the disaster. So I guess that's my way of saying thank you for writing this wonderful book and for your time on this channel with us today.
Thank you so much for the time and the fun conversation with me. It was a very pleasure to chatting with you, especially talking about the modernization. It's a rare chance for me to talk about the modernization with some historians. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I hope our listeners will find this whole discussion about modernization interesting as well, and how modernization shapes or changes lives of those who are along the oceans of the Fukushima areas. If you're interested, please make sure to check out this new book, Fukushima Futures, Survival Stories in a Repeatedly Ruined Seascape by Dr. Satsuki Takahashi. This book is currently available in paperback and hardcover. Stay tuned for our next episode, and goodbye for now.